Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing what I hope is going to turn out to be only the first half of my interview with actor, writer, director, teacher, Frank Galati. In this interview, Frank talks about how he became the extraordinary individual that he is. We were supposed to talk about his direction of 1776 for the Oslo Theater, but we never got around to it before he had to rush off for rehearsal. So I am going to play a song from the original cast album of 1776. If you were listening, you heard Jeff Parker, who is John Dickinson in that production, and also Michael Rice, who is the musical director of that production. And I did get to play some songs, but I love this one that I'm going to play at the end of the show, and I didn't get a chance to play it. So I'm going to play it now in conjunction with, again, what I hope is only the first half of my interview with this amazing, interesting, charming, thoughtful, serious, accomplished band. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap.
Is airing on December 25th, 2012. And so, for any of you who are celebrating Christmas today, I am wishing you the very best Christmas of your life. For those of you who are not celebrating Christmas, I am wishing you the best day of your life, which I am hoping you can have as often as you can tolerate it. For those of you who have never heard the show before, The Lynn Show is all about becoming the person you were meant to be, being all that you can be. I say in every show that as a psychotherapist who's been in practice for, 30 years maybe, it has become clear to me that most of us come out of childhood into adulthood having hidden denied, buried some aspect of ourselves. And although burying those aspects of ourselves was exactly the right thing to do, the self-defensive thing to do, the best choice to make when we made it, later in life, we may very well need precisely that quality which we denied. So people come into therapy with me saying they want to be able to do something that they have not been able to do, or to stop doing something which they want to stop doing. And they think that it's a quality that they're going to have to learn or adopt or find. And we find over and over again that actually they already have it. They just forgot. And so my work, both in my practice and in this show, is about making the point. You are more than you think you are. I say in my book, When You Can, You Will, which speaks about this, that most of us are living out a cover story. It's the truth, it's just not the whole truth about us. And of course, in the book and in many of the shows, I talk about how we can go about recapturing, rediscovering, getting access to those things which we may have had to hide. You can find the book, you can find more information about this, you can get in touch with me in case you'd like to come into therapy with me. Currently, and for the last many years, I've done all of my psychotherapeutic work on the telephone. So if you're curious about any of that, and including what it's like to do therapy on the telephone, there's an article in my on my website called Psychotherapy on the Go. Anyway, you can go to the website. It's thelynshow.com. T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E. S-H-O-W. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. TheLynnShow.com. The other thing I do in this show, whose intention is also to make this point, is that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Because it is so difficult to survive as an artist in our culture, the people who dedicate their life to an art are those for whom it is what they were meant to be. And today's interview is not only not an exception, it's Frank Galati proves the rule. He was meant to be all of the things that he is, although he didn't know it. He says in this interview that he had no ambition or intention to go into the theater, and yet he has made a life of the theater in every way that you can. Teaching, acting and directing, writing. The man is all about theater. And how he arrived at that is the text of this interview. As I said in the run-up to the show, I was supposed to be interviewing him as a promotion for the 1776, which he directed for the Oslo this season as their opening production. But we didn't get to talk about it because he had to rush off to a rehearsal. So I'm hoping that we're going to get another opportunity to finish this interview. I have run interviews of two other people who were intimately connected with the show. Jeff Parker, who played John Dickinson, and Michael Rice, who was the musical director for 1776. If you didn't get a chance to see this production of 1776, I feel sorry for you. I saw it twice and could have seen it again. This production was wonderful, and the play is wonderful. It is the story, if you don't know, of how a bunch of disparate, unlikely men came together to produce the Declaration of Independence and create the United States of America. It's riveting. And in the show I did with Michael Rice, I got to play some of the songs from the original cast album, but I didn't get to play this one, which is, I think, in a way, my favorite. So I'm going to play Sit Down, John, which opens the show. And then I'm going to play my interview with Frank. And then I'm going to play my holiday story, which I do every year at this time. So sit back and enjoy Sit Down, John, and then just enjoy the gift of listening to the extraordinary Frank Galati.
Come to the conclusion that one useless man is called a disgrace, that two are called a law firm, and that three or more become a Congress. And by God, I have had this Congress. For 10 years, King George and his Parliament have gulled, cullied, and diddled these colonies with their illegal taxes. Stamp Acts, Townsend Acts, Sugar Acts, Tea Acts. And when we dared stand up to them like men, they stopped our trade, seized our ships, blockaded our ports, burned our towns, and spilled our blood. And still, this Congress won't grant any of my proposals on independence even so much as the courtesy of open debate. Good God! What in hell are they waiting for?
Sit down, John! Sit down, John! For God's sake, John! Sit down! Sit down, John! Sit down, John! For God's sake, John! Sit down!
Someone ought to open up a window!
It's time to get free! Have mercy, John, please! It's Hotel in Philadelphia!
I say vote, yes, vote for independence, eh?
Someone ought to open up a window.
I say vote, yes,
sit down, John.
Vote for independence, eh?
Someone ought to open up a window.
No, 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 too many flies, yes, too many flies, but it's hot as hell in Philadelphia.
Yes.
No, too many flies here.
Vote yes.
Oh, for God's sake, John, sit down.
Good God, consider yourselves fortunate that you have John Adams to abuse, for no sane man would tolerate it.
John, you're a bore. We've heard this before. Now, for God's sake, John, sit down.
I say vote yes.
No.
Vote yes.
No.
Vote for independence, eh?
Open up a window.
I say vote, yes.
Sit down, John.
Vote for independence.
Will someone shut that man up?
Never. Never.
Okay, I am here with Frank Galati in some room at the Oslo.
Yes. Committee room, I think.
Oh, it has a title.
I think so, you know, board room.
Board, but we are not going to.
No,
be.
We are not.
So, I don't know. I don't know what anyone has told you. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Right.
And right. That's clearly true of you.
Well, I try, yes.
Well, no. Well. I think that's... Well, and you clearly have succeeded for years and years and years. So, now, I know that you're a director and an actor and a writer.
Yes.
Yes. And all of those things somehow connected to theater?
Yes.
If you were going to define yourself, how would you do it?
Well, it's been fascinating in the through the adventure of my life, if I could put it that way, to see how interconnected the things that I've had an opportunity to do really are. I thought I wanted to be a teacher when I was graduating from college, and I went on to get my master's degree. But while I was working on my master's degree, this wonderful, very inspired professor at Northwestern, who was the main acting teacher, her name was Alvina Krauss, and she was revered in the Midwest, and really, I mean, actually, nationally, because students of hers included Charlton Heston and Patricia Neal and Paula Prentice, and actually some of the actors who were in the Broadway production of 1776 were students of hers, Ron Holgate, William Daniels. So while I was working on my master's degree, Miss Krauss was making a first attempt to bring her students into the professional arena in Chicago. So I got my equity card working in a small theater on the south side of Chicago, acting in three plays that she directed, and even designing one of them. I designed one of them, the sets and the props. But I was doing that while I was working on my master's, and I found it very interesting that the scholarship and the reading about literature and text and poetry and language and certainly drama was so useful in, you know, working as an actor, doing 8 shows a week, performing for small audiences, struggling to stay alive, making very little money. But somehow the conversation between what I was doing in the classroom, what I was studying. And then, as I went on, after my master's...
Wait, I want to stop you for a second. Because I want to ask you the question I always ask.
Yeah, sure.
And it predates this.
Yeah.
The question I always ask is, do you remember the very first moment in your life when you became aware of, became interested in, it was triggered, this idea of theater, acting, stories, performance, any of that? Do you remember?
Yeah, I do. the little house that we lived in, where I grew up, was in rural Illinois, far enough away from Chicago so that it was country, it was farmland. Northbrook was a little village. Now it's a very affluent suburb, and, you know, it's 20 minutes from the Loop. But then, in the early 50s, when I was a kid, it was just a little country village. And we had a living room window that was, I guess, a picture window is what we called it in those days. And at night, it became a mirror. And when television first showed up, and my parents and my sister would watch television in that.
About how old were you?
Well, about 10, maybe, or 9.
Okay.
I could stand in the little vestibule that was opposite this picture window and act up and be goofy and make faces. And dance and wave at myself. Watching yourself and becoming aware of yourself and your instrument, you know, you don't know what you're doing, but you're acting up, you're clowning.
Yes.
My grandmother...
Well, you're creating, actually,
well, you're,
right?
You're creating, and you're studying yourself. You know, you're studying the way you can mug and make your face look and twist your face and make your lips do goofy things and your ears. And my grandmother used to say, you be careful if you look like that in a mirror. Your eyes are going to stick like that. Your face is going to stay like that. That's a very, very early memory of the impulse to show off.
Well, yes.
And showing off is what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, display, the word kabuki, for instance, in the Japanese theater, it means talent and performance virtuosity. So I mean, I think when you're sort of in your bones a theater person, it's that kind of antic behavior that gets you started. And that was my whole personality. It still is. I mean, but when I was a kid, I was funny.
You were.
And people laughed at me, and I knew how I learned how to get laughs.
Okay, so now you said sisters?
Sister, I have one sister, younger.
Older, younger, so you're the oldest.
I'm the oldest, yeah. Yes. My sister's a year and a half younger.
And you're the only boy, so
yeah. Man of the child.
Right, exactly.
Of the children,
right.
Yes.
And so did your family find you amusing?
Yes, they did. And my fellow students were, friends who encouraged my crazy behavior. When I was in high school, I lived across the street from an old woman who was often left alone. She was very old. And she had some kind of skin problem on her legs, and her legs were all bandaged up. And in the summer, she would sit out in the backyard, and the flies would gather around her and come land on the bandages on her legs. It always made a very vivid, vivid impression on me. And I used to go over there just to talk to her, because she was such an interesting old character, and because I felt sorry for her. Well, I just started writing, not so much what she said to me, but what I sort of thought she was thinking. I was kind of projecting myself into the character of this old lady. And it turned into a play.
And this is in high school?
In high school,
yeah. Okay, now wait a second. I'm just curious. Were you writing before this?
No.
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 Wow, so we owe her the...
Well, she was the inspiration.
The catalyst, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you say it turned into a play,
mm-hmm.
did you know what a play was?
I did, yes, I did. By that time, in high school, I had seen and been... I was in...
Already?
Our Town.
Oh, in Our Town.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I had a tiny part. I was one of the baseball players. My line was... Hey, George. But, that play is an extraordinary introduction to theater and to American theater.
Yes.
So...
Well, it's interesting because it's an introduction to a certain kind of theater.
Yes.
Right.
You learn later that it's a certain kind of theater.
Right.
But it also, it's the kind of theater which is consciously theatrical. That teaches you not only about the American families in Grover's Corners, but it sort of teaches you about storytelling and about the imagination, about the power of theater to create and project a world with nothing,
yes.
nothing but language,
right.
nothing but words, and the willingness of the audience to share the creation of the reality
to believe
of the world.
It.
To totally and completely believe it, yes.
Yes, so what's interesting to me here is that a little while ago you were talking about, you know, getting your master's and being impacted by the, confluence of, you know, literature and research and it's all literate.
Yeah.
So this is funny to me because here we have this 10-year-old who's making faces in the mirror, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's silly and mm-hmm. it's funny, and you define yourself as a funny guy.
Well, I mean, I admire comedy, and the comic is something that I'm very drawn to.
Yes, but at the same time, here we have you, you know, captured by, it's not funny, Our Town.
No.
No, it's literate, it's serious, it's a story, right?
Yes.
So I don't know. So are you saying you had both of these? That you were drawn to both of these?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, again, our town, it's true that Emily dies, but it's not a tragedy. Its form is comic. And its modality is comic because it's about victory. It's about survival. It's about transcendence, because to posit that the dead are being weaned away from life, are kind of waiting, hovering over their own graves in the cemetery. And when Emily dies and she's welcomed into the chorus of the dead, she says, oh, if I could just go back one more day, if I could just have one day, and they warn her, don't do it.
Don't do it. It's not her death that's devastating in the play. It's that morning in breakfast that's devastating.
That's right. It's her birthday.
Yeah, exactly.
And she says, Mama, look at me. Don't you know?
See me. Yes.
See me. I mean, does anybody...
It still makes me cry.
Well, sure, of course, because it's the most profound question. I mean, does anybody ever live life fully at any given moment? Is anybody really fully there? So it's a play that... It reflects, when I say comedy, the mishaps and the obstacles of everyday life, courtship, marriage, family, the drunken choir master, the nervous parents at the wedding, the kid brothers and sisters, the baseball players, the whole world of Grover's Corners is looked at in a kind of comic light. But on the philosophical level, it asks incredibly deep questions, the kinds of questions that you can only really ask in a work of art. You know, you can't ask in an essay. It's only through the agency of drama and image and poetry and language. Does anyone ever really understand life? Emily says, and I think the stage manager says, saints and poets, maybe. You know.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. When you said, you know, you can't do it in an essay, I think you can do it in an essay, but what you can do in an art form is you can speak directly to the unconscious.
Yes.
You know, the essay will speak to the conscious mind, but the...
That's right.
But the art will speak to the unconscious. And in that way, it touches something very deep.
Yes.
That may not even be conscious. You may not know that you're experiencing.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so we have you in our town, clearly captured, right?
Right.
And
Yes, captured up to a point. I mean, I was compelled enough by the magic of theater to start this little writing exercise, which then my teacher, who was the director of our town, said, oh, you've written a little play. And he read it, and he said, well, you should do it. You should direct it, and we'll put it on.
Oh, my God. Well, so this was, you know, I mean, this was just being given to you over and over again as
it
opportunities,
was.
Right?
Yes, it was. I was very, very lucky. So I got to put on my little play. I cast it. I directed it. And Dr. Lane, he became Dr. Lane after he went back to university. At this time, he was a young high school teacher. But he said, I'm going to leave you alone. I don't want to come to any rehearsals. You do it all yourself, and you do it with your friends, and we'll put it on in our theater. And
what a remarkable guy.
Yeah, Mr. Lane went on to finish his PhD, and then he did not return to high school teaching. He went to join the faculty at Illinois State University in Bloomington Normal. And we remained friends, of course, after I graduated from high school, and he knew about my college life, and I was a graduate student, and he called me. He was on the faculty down there, and he said, Frank, I'd like you to come down and have a look at a couple of my students. I think I've got an amazing batch of kids, and I'd love for you to see them and critique them and work with them over a period of a couple of days.
Okay, now wait a second. What had you done? What were you doing that made him think that this would be something he would want you for?
I was in graduate school at Northwestern University, and I was studying performance. I began in theater. Miss Krause, the professor I mentioned, was on the faculty then. But I transferred from the theater department into this little department, which was focused on the study of all kinds of literature through performance.
This is a specialty, Ethan. Yes, it was a tiny little specialty.
Yes, that's right. And at that time, it was called the Department of Interpretation.
Oh, lovely.
And the textbook that we all used by Charlotte Lee was called Oral Interpretation. And it was about speaking poetry aloud and taking all kinds of texts, short stories, fiction and nonfiction, letters, diaries, journals, and allowing students to come to a real visceral and emotional understanding of these texts by embodying them, by giving them voice and body, rather than just writing. We had to write papers and all that about the literature that we studied. But the modality of study, the pedagogical method, was performance. And I was more interested in, I loved my freshman year, before I went to Western Illinois University, and I transferred to Northwestern, and I got very involved in English, and I loved English literature and stuff. So when I came to Northwestern, I was in theater for a while, but then I transferred to this performance studies department. So Mr. Lane, who was my high school teacher, knew that I was directing and acting and studying in graduate school at Northwestern in the field of performance and criticism.
Even though you were still thinking you were going to be a teacher.
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole business of graduate school was kind of preparatory to a career as a teacher.
So you didn't think you were going to be a performer or
No, I had no ambition to work in the theater.
Little did you know.
Little did I know, I guess. Although, you know, I was still always working in the theater,
yes,
just at school. But what I want to tell you is that when I got down to Bloomington Normal, to Illinois State, and I went to the acting class, the two people that he was wanting me to see and meet were Laurie Metcalf and John Malkovich.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were at the very beginning of the founding of the Steppenwolf Theater Company.
Oh, my goodness.
So Gary Sinise and Jeff Perry and Terry Kinney, Joan Allen, Randy Arney, Tom Irwin, Rondi Reed, these early real pioneers in the regional theater movement, they were all students of Mr. Lane.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was a high school student of Mr. Lane. So when I met all these kids for the first time, and they were kids, I mean, they were college kids.
Mm-hmm. You weren't that much older than them.
No,
right?
I wasn't. I was just a couple of years older.
Right.
So we had a kind of instant connection.
Right.
And we remained, you know, in touch, and as their theater company was born in Highland Park, Illinois, which is where I was born, in the basement of a church, they did their first performances, which I attended. And we were always, when Gary Sinise was the artistic director of Steppenwolf, we were always trying to figure out something that we could do together, if I could direct something there. But it never, I mean, years passed and we never seemed to be able to make something happen until, I think it was around 1985. And by this time, I had finished my PhD at Northwestern. I was a full-time faculty member there. But I was also being encouraged by my colleagues at the university to continue to work in the professional theater, which I started doing with Miss Krause when I was working on my master's.
And already had your equity card.
And I already had my equity card. And I got involved in several shows in the city, so I was known by other actors and directors, and you know, the Chicago theater family was beginning to be kind of formed in those years, and there were groups like the Organic Theater, which Stuart Gordon had founded. David Mamet was working as an apprentice at the Hull House Theater, and Steppenwolf was being formed. So around 1985 or 86, Gary called me up and said, how would you like to direct You Can't Take It With You with us for our holiday show? Well, the idea of Steppenwolf doing a holiday show was something they had never thought of, you know. Right. But they were beginning to realize that they had sort of something going, and that people were coming.
Coming, right.
They were selling tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And they could choose plays that weren't just rock and roll theater, which is the kind of thing that really made them celebrated in the early years. I mean, they did Sam Shepard and Pinter, you know, they did tough rock and roll work.
Right. And serious.
Serious and often violent and,
right,
you know, risky and edgy. So You Can't Take It With You was kind of a, you know, a departure for them. But we had a fantastic time. It was a wonderful cast. And again, Mahoney was in it, Amy Morton was in it, Jet Perry, Rondi Reed, Randy Arney, Tom Irwin, and Alan Wilder, and Gary was the artistic director. So we're in the middle of one day of rehearsal, and I was asked on a break to go up, stop up at Gary's office, which I did, and he said, we'd love you to join the company. Would you join the company? I was kind of shocked because I never expected to be invited to be a member of the ensemble. But of course I said yes, and he said, and you know, I want to encourage you to think about what you would like to do that you think would be right for our actors, you know, but that really reflects your own interest. And I had been thinking for a couple of years about doing The Grapes of Wrath at school as a school project, but it's such an epic novel, and I thought, well, remember Nicholas Nickleby was, mm-hmm, this long 8-hour show that came from Great Britain. And I thought, well, maybe we could do something like that with Grapes of Wrath over 2 nights. Anyway, I proposed The Grapes of Wrath to Gary, and he thought I can still see his face. He just clicked, you know, with the idea. And they had done Of Mice and Men, mm, very successfully. And it had, and a couple of the shows like, one Sam Shepard play, I can't at the moment think of what it was, but and Baum and Gilead, which was a Lanford Wilson play, they had been in New York off-Broadway and gotten wonderful reviews. And it so happened that Elaine Steinbeck, who was John Steinbeck's widow, who lived in Manhattan, was an avid theater goer and someone who, since she was in college, she was a stage manager, she worked in the theater. So she loved the theater. Well, she saw our work in these off-Broadway productions. So when they asked her, you know, there's this little theater company in Chicago that's interested in doing The Grapes of Wrath, she said, oh, I've heard of them. I've seen their work.
Wow.
Yes, we should give them the right to do the script, and then let me see it, and I'll approve it. And
right.
So that's so, you know, that was a huge event in my life.
No kidding.
And
did you write it?
I did. I adapted
right,
the novel and directed it, and we did it in Chicago and then in La Jolla and California and London and then finally, right, on Broadway. But it's interesting in retrospect to see for me, just personally for me, how far back those roots go.
That's, yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
And that is kind of the thing that is so fascinating to me. You can see this, mm, in long careers.
Mm-hmm.
You can see this. You can see where it begins and,
yeah,
how it is in a way inevitable.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
there is a sense of inevitability, mm-hmm, in...
Yes.
What are you thinking?
Well, I was just thinking Tony Walton, who's a set designer.
And who I interviewed.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my wonderful. God, what a wonderful
Well, he was here
guy.
Doing...
He was here, The Devil's...
The Shaw, Devil's Disciple.
Right, I interviewed him.
Yeah.
And Dan, who was the devil.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Well, he's an old friend. We've done shows together. We did opera and musical.
He was so tickled to be being interviewed as a director.
He's a wonderful director, a tremendously articulate and sensitive theater artist. But he had been for so many years kind of pigeonholed as
right.
a set designer. But he used to say to me, you know, Frank, you didn't pick it. It picked you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I realized he was talking about himself, too, that circumstances combine to make essential what it is that you do.
You know, I have 10, 12 interviews with people where it's blatantly obvious. They didn't even know it was a career.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It grabbed them and took them in.
You
know the term Bashert?
Yeah, oh yeah, sure.
That's what it feels
yes,
like.
Exactly.
To me, you know,
yes.
And I
yes. Yeah.
So yet again,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And it's mystifying, you know. It's
I thought you were gonna say it's mystical.
Well and mystical.
Well, I think it's mystifying. Well, I mean again, this is it's mystifying unless you believe there is such a thing as, you know, then it's not mystifying. It's just, why isn't it clearer? Why doesn't everybody have it? Why does it happen to some?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I know. And I always felt that I just didn't intend to do what
your life has
I wound
become.
Up doing. I didn't. So many of my friends after college went to New York or Los Angeles, and I stayed in Chicago. And I stayed because after I started teaching at the University of South Florida, I really loved it. And that's why I went back to finish my PhD, and I was just unbelievably fortunate to get a job at Northwestern. One of my professors retired just at the time that I, a couple of years after I finished my PhD,
mm-hmm.
and they asked me to step in, and I did. And so, you know, my teaching career was like 42 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And at the same time, developing this other work. I mean, your work
yes.
in the professional theater.
Yes, and very often, like with The Grapes of Wrath and lots of other things, I tried things out at school. I would test material with my students. I would get my students to perform and adapt and explore works of literature that sometimes became so interesting to me that I would then take them onto, you know, a kind of larger canvas or a bigger arena. Recently in Chicago in the last like 5 years, I've done a few pieces by Haruki Murakami, who's a Japanese writer, very popular in Asia, and pretty popular in the U.S. in translation. But right after 9/11, I could sense a level of anxiety in my students that made working on period pieces. I always taught the Dubliners, James Joyce's Dubliners, mm-hmm. and I loved it. My students loved it too. But I began to sense a sort of a disconnect. Why are we studying these turn-of-the-century families in this very specific neighborhood of Dublin on Richmond Street, on North Richmond Street? Why are we going to these pubs, and why are we staying home with these parents, and why are we dreaming with these young lovers? It was harder to answer that question, and I kept looking for something that would be more immediate for my students. And I had been reading Murakami, and I came across a collection of short stories which was just published around that time called After the Quake. And it was like Dubliners, it was six stories that were all connected. And in the case of After the Quake, it was the 1995 Kobe earthquake. Where I think 65,000 or something people were killed or injured. And each one of the stories with slightly different even stylistic aspects. One of them is almost like a comic book, and one of them is like a very sort of strange avant-garde film, and another one is like a romance. So, but anyway, they're written in very plain, very contemporary prose. And although it's Japan, the world is so homogenized.
I was just going to say, it's a modern world.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't matter. I mean, it's the same computer technology, it's the same transportation system, it's the same fast food, it's the same clothing labels and shoe styles and all of that. Mm-hmm. So you can't tell that you're in Japan. But what you can tell with each of these stories is that there has been a catastrophic event.
Right.
And that this catastrophic event is haunting the dreams of these young people. So my students dug it, and we did, I must have 3 or 4 years used those stories, and then I happened to be talking to Martha Levy, who's the artistic director at Steppenwolf, and I said, I wonder if I could make an evening of theater by combining a couple of these stories. She encouraged me to go ahead. Well, we did. I did After the Quake, and it was very successful in Chicago. We played it also at the Long Wharf mm-hmm. in out east, and we played it at the La Jolla Playhouse.
I'm just thinking, so teaching for you got to be kind of a lab.
Yeah, that's right.
That's great.
Oh, yeah, it was fantastic. And my students would come to the theater when I was directing.
Of course,
they would see
and they,
performances
right.
when I was
they
acting.
They could see the,
yeah,
the fruition
yeah.
of what they were
yeah,
doing.
Yeah.
And the difference, too, if there was, between
Absolutely.
What they could do and what professionals could do.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I always felt, you know, confident in talking to students about performance because I was performing.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. You know what it is.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and the other thing I was thinking, and I know you, I mean, this is self-evident, but, well, maybe, I don't know. How much teaching and directing
yes.
are
yes.
the same, similar?
Yes,
way,
yes.
Right?
Yes, and you know, playwrights act.
Yes.
They're the ones who create the characters, and in so doing, they act.
Yes,
the characters.
They become the
characters. They impersonate
they, right,
the characters.
Right.
They conjure
they embody.
Up the characters. Mm. They embody
right,
the characters.
Right, right, right.
And directors teach, and teachers direct,
right.
and directors act.
And it's okay.
It's all performance.
It's well, it's all that standing in front of the mirror.
Yeah, that's right.
it comes full circle.
Rather key. Yes.
Okay, so now I'm very upset that we're not going to have more time.
Well, and we could meet again.
So, do you mind?
No, not at all. No.
The truth is, I could listen to and talk to Frank Galati indefinitely, and I would just be one of the legion. Because if you were listening to the last 2 weeks, and if you're listening next week, you will have heard Jeff Parker talk about what it's like to work with Frank. Michael Rice talk about what it's like to work with Frank. And next week, Brendan Fox talking about what it was like to work with Frank. And they all say similar things about how extraordinary it is and how wonderful it is to just listen to him, to be in his presence, to watch him work. So, again, I'm looking forward to another chance to talk to Frank. But just listening to this interview, of course, Frank makes the point for me, which is that one can know who one is moment to moment. One can look at what is happening. Do I want this? Don't I want this? Does it fit me? Doesn't it fit me? Not that many people have Frank's ability simply to put one foot in front of the other and find it where it's meant to be. And of course, as we both seem to say in this interview, serendipity, circumstances, the universe, destiny. Those things seem to conspire for some people, and it certainly seemed to be there for Frank. But for Frank, if destiny said, here, do this, Frank could. You know, he did. He embraced it. And that's the message that I am trying so to send, that there is a destiny for you, and you may not yet be living it, but that doesn't mean you can't. Okay, so I'm running in on the end of this Christmas Day show, and I have yet to play my holiday story, which I'm going to do now. I think we'll go out on my holiday story. And so let me now thank once again Josh Hackney for yet another year of incredible help. I could not do much of what I do without Josh's help. And, you know, in a way, this is part of knowing who you are. I know what I can and what I can't do. And when I come up against something I can't do, I look around for someone who can. And in this instance, in the instance of computers and electronics and recording and iPhones and all that stuff, Josh can. And he does. And he has my incredible great gratitude. And if you need any help with any of that, you want to call Josh. And you can find him also by going up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynshow. Click on email me and say you want Josh. Or you want me. I'm hopeful that you will ask me whatever questions you have, that you will give me whatever comments you have, that if you like the show and or the shows, you will mention that in whatever social media you use, that you will go up on the website and listen to some of the extraordinary interviews. Interviews with some extraordinary people, like Frank Galati, and you could listen to this interview again if you wanted to. So here is my holiday story. This really happened to me, and I think it's incredible. Maybe you will too. So I am hoping that you are having the Christmas you want, that you will be having a year in which you are more and more and more your real self, and that you will come back next week, same time, same station, because I will be here and I sure hope you will be too. I'm on a plane flying from Sarasota, Florida to Atlanta, Georgia. And I'm sitting next to an older man who looks to me like he's in some distress. And I asked him if he was okay, and he said yes, that he was. A little while later, it looked to me like he was sort of falling asleep and jerking awake, and I asked him again if he was okay. And he said that he had taken some medication for his back, and he thought that might be having an impact on him. And although he still didn't look good to me, I didn't want to bother him anymore. I didn't want to embarrass him. So I didn't say anything until the plane was descending. And as the plane descended, I looked over at him, and it looked to me like he had fallen asleep with his eyes open. And I really got concerned. And so even though we were descending, I got out of my seat, and I went down to the stewardess and explained that I thought my seatmate might be having a heart attack or a stroke. She put me in her seat and went back to see what to do about him. We landed. I got up and was exiting the plane when the stewardess came over and said my seatmate wanted to see me. She walked me over to him, and he had an oxygen mask on his face. I couldn't see him. But he took my hand and he squeezed it. It was very emotional for me, actually. But I forgot about it as, you know, something that happened in the past. Several years went by, and then it was closing in on the holidays, and I met a friend for lunch, someone I don't see that often, and we found this place to meet. And I was returning home, and I passed the Women's Exchange, which is a consignment shop here, where I sometimes donate clothing and things. And they have a list of the dates that you can donate. And I thought, oh, hell, let me stop in there and get the list. So I pulled into the parking lot, went in, picked up the list, and then I thought, now I'm here. Let me look at the couches. I mean, I wasn't going to buy a couch, but okay, fine. So I went over, and they've got all these couches, right? And I'm standing in front of this big brown couch. A man came over, stood behind me, and said, do you like that couch? And now, I've been to this place a lot of times. No one has ever, none of the staff has ever come over to ask me if I liked something. But, you know, I said, yeah, I like this couch. And he said, well, I don't think this is good for you. Why not? I said. He said, because you see how wide it is, and you're so short. I don't think your feet will reach the ground. He said, see, I'm tall, and it's good for me. And he sat down to show me that. But I don't think it'll work for you. So I took my shoes off and sat down on the couch and tucked my feet under me, which is how I sit. And I said to him, but you see, this is how I sit, so I think it'd be okay. And he said, you know, a couple of years ago, a woman who sat just like you saved my life on a plane. And of course I said, that's because it was me. And I don't know which one of us was more startled or amazed. We continued to tell the story to each other back and over and over and over. And I remember thinking as I was driving home that the holiday season is a season of miracles. And I remember wondering if maybe there really are still miracles.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated. Oh, leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still sure got some tang, so you won't hear me simper. I may have got good.